Welcome to a podcast of the American Mineralogist. I am Rachel Russell, the managing editor. Our October 2006 issue is a special issue devoted to planetary materials from the Earth to the Moon and beyond, and the papers were organized by special associate editors Charles Scheer, Ted Lobotka, and Dave Vanneman, and they are in honor of Jim Papike. My guest today is Jim Papike. Let me tell you a few things about him. Jim Papike has been a part of everything, including the Apollo program to the moon, Continental Scientific drilling, DOE working groups on geologic disposal of nuclear waste, and an advisor to NASA on planetary missions continuously since 1969. He is a past president of MSA and the Geochemical Society. He is a mineralogist, petrologist, geochemist, geological engineer, and much more. He joined the USGS after receiving his PhD in geology, physical chemistry in 1964. After 5 years with the USGS in Washington, D.C., he went to the first Earth and Space Science Department in the United States at Stony Brook, New York. After 2 years, he was promoted to full professor and chair. After 12 years, he went west to South Dakota Tech, where he received his B.S. in Geological Engineering, and formed and directed a new Institute for the Study of Mineral Deposits, using the Black Hills of South Dakota as a natural laboratory. After 9 years at South Dakota, he left to become director of the Institute of Meteoritics at the University of New Mexico, Albuquerque. He retired as director in July 2002 and is now a senior research professor and continues research in planetary mineralogy and in advising NASA on planetary missions. Jim, welcome to the podcast.
Rachel, thanks for the beautiful introduction.
You're welcome. How did you get into planetary sample studies in the first place?
Well, Rachel, I'll be a little lengthy here on that one because little did I know that that's where I'd end up. So what I'm going to do is answer that basically by referring to five stages of my early career in life. Stage one is growing up in northern Minnesota. Stage two is going to South Dakota School of Mines and Technology. Stage three is going to the University of Minnesota. Stage four is working with the USGS, and stage five is when I went to Stony Brook, and it also coincides in 69 with the first Apollo landing. So stage one, growing up in northern Minnesota, I worked in and lived among iron ore mines. This led to interest in mining and geological engineering, and my father enthusiastically endorsed my going in that direction. So in stage two, I did go to South Dakota Tech and got a degree in geological engineering and did get married and had a child on the way. And I had assumed that this was going to be it. I thought if you were an engineer, then you knew everything. And I had five good job offers, and I was ready to have a life. But my undergraduate advisors wouldn't hear of it. They said, no, Jim, you have to go to graduate school. So I applied to the University of Minnesota and went there in the fall of 1959. And I didn't really know what I wanted to do, but I met with some of the new professors. And the one who really got my ear and my interest was Professor Tibor Zoltai, who was a crystallographer. And I didn't really think I wanted to go into crystallography, because I wanted to be more of a generalist and understand how rocks formed. But Tibor convinced me that I could do some new innovative work in understanding rocks or the field of petrology by using a crystallographic or crystal chemical approach. And so already then, as a grad student, I coined the name petrologic crystal chemistry, did my PhD thesis on the scapolite minerals, and continued working on rock-forming minerals to this day. Another important event, a very, very important event during stage three at the University of Minnesota, is I met a giant in his field, Dr. Paul Gast, who did pioneering work in geochemistry. Well, Paul was a consultant with NASA, and Paul told me that NASA was planning on going to the moon and returning samples in the time frame of 1969. In fact, I was taking a geochemistry course from Paul, and on one exam, there was only one question, and it said, if you receive some of the first lunar samples, what types of data would you obtain on them and why? Well, after that, I got to thinking, and this convinced me that I wanted to be a part of this great adventure whenever it happened. Stage four, I went to the USGS and I was hired to lead an initiative on the rock forming silicates in the Crystal Chemical Group in Washington, D.C. And for those 5 years, I emphasized pyroxenes and amphiboles. So, stage five, 1969, is when Apollo landed, and I also went as an associate professor to the State University of New York at Stony Brook. My telephone rang, and it was Professor Paul Gast, who had moved. He actually moved from Minnesota to Columbia, and then from Columbia down to the Johnson Space Center. And he was leading the effort on the lunar sample return, making sure that JSC was in the state of readiness. And he invited me to serve as mineralogist on then probably the most powerful NASA committee. It was called the Lunar Sample Analysis Planning Team, or LSAPT. We did many, many exciting things. We were in mission control during the Apollo missions. We debriefed the astronauts on return from the moon and watched them unpack the rocks. We allocated samples to the international community. And Rachel, the rest is history.
Here you are.
Yep.
Yeah, that's amazing how one thing leads to another.
It does.
Why has the central themes of all your research been on crystal chemistry, minerals as probes of petrologic and geochemical processes, and comparative planetary mineralogy?
Okay, Rachel, on that, several things happened. The first I already alluded to that basically I'd like to point out that when Tibor Zoltai was trying to convince me you could do something important by thinking crystochemically, I had to convince myself. But when I was a graduate student, I heard about two giants in the field. One was Professor Jim Thompson at Harvard, who used a crystal chemical approach to petrology. And then there was Ted Ringwood in Australia, who was modeling the mantle with crystal chemical concepts. And so I really believed then, during my graduate school days, I first realized in grad school, and then was totally convinced during my 5 years at the USGS, that minerals had clues to their petrologic and geochemical history that had not been fully exploited. That record is stored in a kind of a complicated way in the details of crystal structures and phenomena such as order, disorder, phase transitions, exsolution, and the like. So that was the first. Then, when I actually started studying the Apollo samples, I realized that the moon's surface was covered with regolith, or lunar soil that was created by impacts, and a large proportion of it was composed of minerals, not rocks. The rocks broke down to individual minerals. I thought it likely that sample returns from other planets would also return regolith, and that we had to figure out a way to get the maximum information from individual minerals. So that's why I used that approach. The comparative planetary mineralogy awareness came later. I was serving on a committee, an advisory committee to the Lunar and Planetary Institute in Houston. We were asked to come up with a concept in comparative planetology. And in 1976, we did that and came up with the title Basaltic Volcanism on the Terrestrial Planets. I was responsible for leading the research and writing the chapter on silicates from planetary basalts from the Earth, the Moon, and meteorites. At that time, well, they were basaltic meteorites. At that time, we didn't realize that these were not only from basaltic asteroids, mainly for Vesta, but also one of them, Shergadi, was from Mars. We did not realize that at the time. But later on, we understood that we had meteorites from Mars and the Moon, And so then I started with my colleagues comparative planetary mineralogy, emphasizing pyroxene, plagioclase, olivine, and spinel from planetary basalts. And more recently, my efforts now are comparing sulfates from Mars and Earth. The planets really are natural laboratories. The planets leave their fingerprints on individual minerals as well as rocks. So we can really invert it by finding a meteorite, and even if it's a tiny one, we have clues in the chemistry to tell which planet they came from. So that's the wrap on that one, Rachel.
That's fascinating. What was the most exciting part of your scientific career, at least so far, and why?
Well, Rachel, that's an easy one. I don't have to really think too much about that. Apollo and the Apollo missions, without a doubt, the period 69 through 72. Some of us go through life not knowing when they hit their high point. When you were a part of Apollo, you knew that was the time. Just think about it. Man's first stepping foot on another planetary body and returning samples that could be studied for years. How can you top that?
It's still amazing to me. I
Me
would.
too. It was the one time in my life that the whole world was unified.
Yes. I was just a little kid, but I remember that as well. What, if anything, would you like to change about how we explore the terrestrial planets?
Yes, I'm a fan of NASA, as you can tell by how much time I've spent working on NASA committees and with them and for them. However, we are not in lockstep in terms of the proper way to set up a exploration campaign of the terrestrial planets. I feel that there should be more sample return missions. Not only, well, of course, we've returned samples from the moon and will again, but we also must return samples from the surface of Mars, Venus, and Mercury. We have to do this to understand these planets. A good example of this is your recent reviews in Mineralogy and Geochemistry Volume Number 60, New Views of the Moon. That actually concept started when I was chairing that same committee I told you about, LESAP, which has a new name now, and it doesn't matter what that new name is, but we started that in part to demonstrate how you study a planet by integrating sample data with remotely sensed data, orbital data, and landed in situ measurements. Now, if one reads that book, it's a long and very impressive book. You'll find out that 90 to 95% about what we know about the moon today, its origin and evolution, was derived from the study of samples. The same will be likely true for Mars, but no sample returns are planned. So to me and a number of my colleagues, we are really quite disappointed because NASA has decided to back off sample return from Mars. And some of us are unhappy with that.
Absolutely. What is your linkage to the three co-editors, Chip Shear, Ted Lobotka, and Dave Vanneman?
Well, of my many friends and colleagues, these are three very special people, and I'll introduce that in chronological order. I met Dave Vanneman in 1975-76 when I went on sabbatical to the University of California at Santa Cruz. Dave then was finishing up his PhD with two of my former postdocs who were on the faculty then at Santa Cruz, Ken and Mary Ellen Cameron. During my year there, Dave worked for me part-time, but I was so impressed with him, I hired him as a postdoc when he finished, and he returned with me to Stony Brook. So we've been friends and colleagues ever since, and we don't live very far from each other. He's in Los Alamos, and I'm here in Albuquerque, so we see a lot of each other. Ted Lobotka, next. When I returned from my sabbatical in the fall of 76, I decided I needed a second postdoc in metamorphic petrology because I was planning a number of studies in northern Minnesota on metamorphosed iron formations and related rocks. Ted Lobotka was just finishing his PhD at Caltech with Arden Elbe as his advisor, and he came highly recommended. I hired him, and again, we've been friends and colleagues ever since. Last but certainly not least, Chip Shear. I moved to South Dakota in January of 1982, and later that year, I hired my first senior research staff member, and that was Chip Shear. He was just finishing his PhD at the University of Massachusetts Amherst with Peter Robinson and Toni Morris, two friends of mine and colleagues at the time. He came highly recommended. I hired Chip. Chip is still working. We're still working together, and this is almost 25 years, so that is really quite incredible. So that's that.
That's amazing. Thank you for listening to this podcast. American Mineralogist publishes earth science research articles for mineralogy, geology, crystallography, and many, many other facets of earth and planetary science. American Mineralogist is published by the Mineralogical Society of America, a nonprofit publisher. MSA welcomes tax-deductible donations for the journal, this podcast, or the many programs of the society. For more information about MSA, check out www.minsocam.org. Check back with each new issue to see if there are new podcasts.